The Orange FM.
Ready to form Voltron. Activate interlocks. Dinotherms connected. Impracel up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome to Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. I am Mark Morrell, your host, and today I am joined by a special guest host who will be helping me review another four episodes from the original series, Voltron, Defender of the Universe, back in 1984. You remember him as our guest interview in podcast episode number 7, and the writer of the Devil Do Publishing Voltron comics, Mr. Dan Jolly. Welcome back, Dan.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So, what have you been up to since our last episode?
I have actually spent 3 months in Poland working on the video game that I'm currently on the writing team for. That is an upcoming game called Dying Light.
Dying Light?
Yes.
What is that about?
It's a first-person survival horror game, but it's got a few new elements I think people are going to enjoy seeing. I like to describe it as parkour versus zombies.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. It's
parkour versus zombies. Who's producing that one?
That's a company called Techland. They did the game Dead Island.
Okay.
And so this is not a sequel to that, but it's sort of like the spiritual successor, I guess you could say.
And specifically, what things did you put into it? All the scripting?
No, there was a story in place when I got there. Originally, they wanted me to basically naturalize the dialogue. And then the more I shot my mouth off, the more we started talking about the story. One thing led to another, and so now the story has a lot of my fingerprints all over it.
Okay.
I'm not the lead writer, and it should not say story by me because there are other people involved, but I have contributed significantly.
What kind of interesting things did you see in Poland?
You know, I did not know what to expect. When they said, hey, do you want to work on this game? I was thinking this is going to be a remote job, you know, and I'll just sit here in my home office in my pajamas and do my work like I normally do.
Pajamas.
And well, yeah, so I'm dressed right now.
That's great.
Then they said, well, do you think you could do some on-site work? And I was talking to the Vancouver office, and I thought, oh, you know, sure, I'll go back to Vancouver. I love Vancouver. And then they said, well, no, we're talking about Wrocław, Poland. And, you know, Poland was not really on the list of places I expected to go. So I didn't know what to expect when I got there. But, you know, it is really not anywhere near as different as I thought it would be.
Okay.
The people that I met there are very, very much like people in the States. Plus, a whole bunch of them speak really good English.
Oh, wow.
If you're under 35 there, chances are really good that you speak enough English to converse with someone. And a whole bunch of people there speak fluent English.
Wow.
And I did not know a word of Polish before I went, but I got the, and I guess this is a free plug here for the software. I got the level 1 Rosetta Stone program for Polish and learned a good bit just like in about a month and a half of study. So I was able to speak enough Polish to get by as far as like making purchases at the grocery store and stuff like that.
Okay.
I didn't really see much of Poland other than Wrocław, which looks like it should be pronounced Roclaw in English. It's okay. W-R-O-C-L with a slash through it, A-W.
Okay.
But yeah, that's Wrocław. It was just really cool. I mean, it was an incredibly awesome experience. I'm really glad that I went. 3 months was a little bit long to be away from my wife, but I did get to come home a couple of times to visit, so it wasn't unbearable.
Okay. All right. So other than the video game, what else have you been working on?
Well, I've got a Terminator miniseries currently running at Dark Horse Comics called Enemy of My Enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And that's drawn by Jamal Igel and Ray Snyder, colored by a fellow who I have not met personally, and I'm not sure how to pronounce his name properly, so I'll probably mess it up. But I believe it's pronounced Wes Gioba.
Okay.
And I'm really, really happy with this comic book. It's a story set entirely in 1985. With a different cast of characters, different Terminator, different set of circumstances. But it is within the parameters set by the first movie. And it's coming along really, really well. And I've got a few other comic book projects in the works that I can't talk about yet.
Okay. All right. Are you making any other trips or any conventions anytime soon?
August 1st through 3rd, I will be in Atlanta at the first annual Monsterama convention.
Wow. Monsterama.
Monsterama, yeah. And September, I think, 19th through 21st, I believe are the dates, in Louisville, Kentucky, I will be at Imaginarium, which is a convention that focuses on creative writing.
Okay.
In fact, I am their comic book imaginator. They have special guests for each of the different genres. And they selected me to be their official comic book guy.
Nice.
Yeah, so the term for that they're using is imaginator.
Okay.
So I'll be up there running off at the mouth a lot about the comics industry.
All right, cool. All right, well, the Let's Voltron podcast will be making an appearance at RetroCon in Oaks, PA, September 27th and 28th, and we'll be there with Bad Wolf Radio, and that's under the Orange FM network, and we'll be looking forward to seeing the fans face-to-face for the first time as a podcast. And then also, I will be going with my wife to San Diego Comic-Con starting on Tuesday.
Oh, very nice.
We are going to have some Let's Voltron surprises that will come out of that I will not tell anybody about yet until after we get back and have everything recorded. So I will also be doing some interviews for Toon Barn there while I'm there.
Excellent.
So look forward to that. One thing I wanted to mention before we get into the episode reviews is that we recently closed a campaign with Teespring.com for a t-shirt that is the Let's Voltron logo t-shirt. And the Teespring campaign was a success. We had originally started with hoping for a goal of 50, but you're allowed to lower your goal one time through the campaign, and we lowered it to 35, and we just reached that 35 total. So it was a success. Everybody who ordered a t-shirt on teespring.com will get it, and those should be shipping out by August 1st. If you didn't get a chance to get a t-shirt, fear not, because you can still go to teespring.com/letsvoltron for another 4 weeks, because they've got a button on the page that says, wait, I still want one. So you can still get a t-shirt for the next 4 weeks, and it will be shipped to you as soon as it gets produced. All right, so thank you very much for ordering those t-shirts, and thank you for supporting the podcast.
Today, featuring Voltron of the Far Universe.
Now let's move right on into our episode review. We are starting with Episode 9, A Pretty Spy. That's the Voltron title. The Golion title is Girl of the Land of Evil.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
All right, so this episode starts off with an alert from Karan to report to the control tower. An unidentified space cruiser is on the display, one of Zarkon's pursuit ships from Planet Doom. But three more ships are attacking, and this confuses the team. Karan suggests it could be a trick to break through their defense perimeter. And as they watch, the ship is shot in the back, leaving a section of the ship in flames. And it ends up crashing behind a mountain. Keith wonders if anyone could have survived the crash. So at this point, if you're watching it, what do you think, Dan? What do you think's going on?
You know, I can't help but wonder what happened to the ships that were pursuing the one that crashed.
Yeah, all of a sudden they just disappeared, right?
They're just gone.
That should have been a clear indicator, shouldn't it have?
And it was the same in the Go Lion episode. Because before this podcast, I had not ever seen any of the Go Lion episodes. So this has been a great experience for me, but I was sort of expecting to see in the Go Lion version, the castle launches missiles and those other three ships are destroyed. But no, they just amble off somewhere.
Right. So for the first time, we get to see Hunk coming out on horseback to go after this crash site. Hunk finds a woman lying on the ground near the wreckage. She has the same tattoo on her left arm near the wrist that signifies she's a Drool slave on Planet Doom. She's dressed in ragged plain clothes with long red hair tied in a ponytail. And Hunk sees that she's still breathing and determines she's alive and brings her back to the castle where she is attended to by Nanny and some nurses. So any ideas on who she might be at this point?
These are some awfully trusting people, I have to say. And you know, I don't...
For everything they've been through, right?
Yeah. And I don't want to, like, you know, be a jerk and point out flaws and stuff like that. But, I mean, when I was doing the Devil's Due comics, and I watched all of these episodes again, you know, I watched them all with great fervor when I was a young teenager.
Uh-huh.
And the feeling that I get... That I got from watching them is that it's like there's a really good story and some really good characters, and it's kind of like you're having to look at them through glass bricks, you know, like you have to get past some bizarre choices that were probably made because of production concerns,
right?
Let's bring this woman into the castle, no questions asked, and don't bother looking at what she might have on her, like secret compartments in boot heels.
you don't think they scan anybody that comes into the castle?
I guess they don't.
I guess not. All right. While she's there being attended to, Pidge, Lance, Keith, and Hunk are told to leave so that she can get some rest. Now, while they're walking down the corridor, Pidge wonders how she was able to escape Planet Doom. Well, Keith wonders if she's really escaped. And Hunk, wow, he goes ballistic. He quickly snaps. What do you mean you saw her spaceship get shot down by Zarkon's fighters? She must have escaped Planet Doom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And Pidge reminds the team that they were the only ones ever to escape from Zarkon's slave pits. And there were five of them.
Yeah.
How could one girl all by herself escape?
Well, it's a valid question. And, you know, Hunk's reaction in the Voltron series, he's kind of generally depicted as like a big teddy bear. In Go Lion, for probably those few other than me who haven't seen it or had only just seen it recently, his character's name, his nickname is Hothead.
Right.
And that makes a lot more sense, like his reaction to her name in Voltron is Twyla. As opposed to the actually more normal English name Lisa in Go Lion.
Makes you wonder why our writers didn't say Lisa still.
Yeah. And I know that when they're putting together the Voltron episodes, the producers did not have access to, like, translations.
Right.
But it really makes me wonder, because there's an element of the story coming up that... If they had no idea that it was a feature of the story, they guessed really, really well.
Yes, they did. And I think Jameson Brewer was the one that made all those names in the beginning. So Twyla was probably Jameson Brewer's name.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Getting back to the story, Princess Alora assures the girl that nothing will happen to her under the protection of the castle and the Voltron Force. And they find out her name is Twyla. And she said Zarkon was going to torture her because she refused to be his slave. Zarkon captured her whole family. And her brother and her were brought there, and they started whipping her brother. And she saw a chance to get away, and she jumped into the same spaceship that brought them there. Now Hunk punches the wall and says, "One day, Zarkon, you're going to pay." Yeah, Hunk is still fired up here. They're all, you know, upset about this whole taking people as slaves thing, and you know, they don't appreciate that, even though there's nothing they've really done to this point to go after Planet Doom and, you know, free all the slaves.
Yeah, that's an element throughout this series that, like, my friends, when I go see a movie or something and I'm, like, picking apart story details, and they're like, Dan, why can you not just enjoy a movie? And it's a writer thing. You know, there's the saying, when you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail.
Right.
And I absolutely cannot keep myself from analyzing story details. And it seems like the Drool forces can just kind of show up whenever they feel like it.
Right.
You know, there's certainly no army. There's no planetary defense system. They just show up.
And that might be the reason that they hold back and don't go anywhere, because they get attacked so much.
Yeah.
That they just might think, well, we are in a defense capability here, so let's keep it that way. Later that night, though, when the four are talking, they're thinking about attacking Zarkon with Voltron, and mm-hmm. Hunk suggests bending the rule of using Voltron for defense only, just this once.
Right.
But we all know that will never happen, right?
I'd be on Hunk's side there. It seems like a good idea to me.
All right. So Keith is still bothered by the fact that Twyla's escape from Doom happened, and he thinks it was too easy.
Yeah.
And Hunk questions if Keith is calling her a liar.
What do you mean?
Well, it was too easy. The running away, the available ship nearby.
You calling her a liar? You saw her slave tattoo. You saw her plane shot down by Zarkon's men. Hey, come on. We saw how he treated slaves when he had us trapped there. He and his whole evil gang ought to be run out of the galaxy.
Okay, okay, I agree with you. Easy, hon, calm down.
Just don't knock that nice girl. Ooh, ooh.
You know, Hunk's obviously protective of her since he was the one who found her.
Yeah, yeah, he went out on that horse instead of in his armored battle vehicle for some reason.
Is that any kind of story trope for a writer when you're the one that finds somebody who has been injured, you know, in a crash like that, you feel protective of them, you feel responsible for them to keep them from getting into harm?
I think that's kind of a human nature thing, really. I mean, I know that several different cultures have the sort of unspoken feeling that if you save someone's life, you're responsible for them. And it does seem like Hunk definitely feels responsible for Twyla here.
Yeah.
Whether he should or not.
But the hothead that he is, he's never been this angry. I mean, he says he and his whole evil gang ought to be run out of the galaxy as he grabs Keith by the shirt. And Lance and Pidge have to actually physically hold him back.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't have a good explanation for that. That's just kind of weird.
Yeah, so that same night, Twyla's eyes light up as she's under a spell, it seems like, and she walks around the castle and makes sure that the others are sleeping. Now, Keith hears something and goes to investigate. He thinks he must have been dreaming, and he goes back to bed. Now, why do you think her eyes light up at this point? Now, it might be something a little bit different in Golion, right?
Yeah, we don't really get a good explanation in the Voltron episode for what she is. I mean, she's under Hagar's influence.
Well, that's what my thought was in the Voltron episode, is that Hagar's doing all this.
But in the Golion, I you could probably call Lisa a mutant, because Hagar, I mean, I'm blanking on her name in the Golion, the witch. Hinerva.
Hinerva, yeah.
Yeah. She picked Lisa out. She's like, oh, hey, there's a girl with psychic powers.
Right.
I'm going to do stuff with her, make her do things for me. So all of these abilities just are Lisa's. And it makes me wonder how many other humans have like substantial psychic abilities like this. Because at one point, Hunk says, or excuse me, Hothead says, well, you're human like us, and doesn't bat an eye at all the amazing stuff that she's been able to do.
Exactly. So, you know, you've got Hagar who has powers. You've got, obviously, Merla has powers. I guess even Princess Alora, she can talk to mice.
She sure can.
And, of course, she can talk to the ghost of her father. So, I mean, there's some, you know, mystical stuff that goes on in the Voltron universe, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. He doesn't even bat an eye. Anyway, that same night, we're back to her walking around the castle. And Twyla runs to a door that's labeled Missile Block 4. Now here's what I don't understand. You saw the Go Lion episode of this, right?
Mm-hmm.
It still said Missile Block 4, right? In English, right?
Yeah.
I was wondering why that wouldn't have been in Japanese.
Well, you know, Eris seems to be populated by just a whole bunch of white people.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's no surprise that tons of Japanese entertainment, particularly the animated variety, stars a whole bunch of Caucasians.
Right.
So, you know, maybe maybe the original creators of the series were thinking that everyone on Eros spoke English, and they just were translating it to Japanese for their audience.
Okay.
I don't know.
I just thought that was strange.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like on the above the doors where everybody comes out when they've been sleeping, it says like R113, R115.
Right.
In English.
Right. Well, I know their numbers are still the same as ours, you know.
Yeah, but I mean the letter R.
Right, exactly. All right, so she comes to this Missile Block 4 door, and her eyes light up again. She puts her hands together and bolts of electricity shoot out from her hands, opening the door.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the space mice are in the background and they see her there and they follow her. Now, in the missile room, Twyla starts glowing and she lifts her arm up and calls to Planet Doom. Slave Twyla calling from Planet Eris. So apparently she has this connection to Planet Doom. On Doom, Zarkon hears the voice of our pretty spy and tells Hagar to answer her. Hagar asks if she has carried out her orders. Twyla says she's in the missile room, and Hagar tells her to get the bomb that will set off the missiles and destroy the castle.
Mm-hmm.
So as the space mice watch, Twyla pulls a small transmitter device from the heel of her shoe, and they run to get help.
Yeah, that device is actually the bomb itself.
It's a pretty small bomb.
It is. It is. There must be some pretty advanced explosives technology at work there.
Right. It makes you wonder why Doom hasn't used this before.
Yeah, it does.
So on Doom, Hagar tells Zarkon, everything is going according to plan. The girl is still under my spell. Soon, Voltron will be destroyed along with the castle, and Eris will be defenseless, ready for total destruction by our claw beast. Zarkon applauds her efforts, and she says her only desire is to see him become master of the universe, and an evil laugh ensues. So does the same explanation happen in Go Lion here?
It's a little simpler, actually, because when when Lisa lights up and contacts Planet Doom, she's contacting Hinerva directly and using her own abilities, like her own telepathy. And she doesn't say, this is Slave Twyla. She says, this is Lisa, the saboteur.
Right.
And like the motivation that is ultimately revealed, which is that the bad guys have promised, I'm using the bad guys because I don't want to say both sets of names, but
right.
the promise has been made to release the people who are slaves there in the castle. You know, it's just like you take out an extra step. There's no magical compulsion. This is somebody with some pretty amazing abilities, and she made a deal. And I prefer that story. Usually the simpler, the better.
Right. And of course, whenever you make a deal with evil, it doesn't always turn out the way it seems, huh?
Right.
All right, so when the space mice try to wake up the team, Pidge thinks they just want a midnight cheese snack. but Keith senses something's wrong and tells the team to roll out. One of the mice gets to Allura, and since she can understand them, she's horrified. So as Twyla gets the bomb on a timer, the team makes it to the control room. They wake up Karan and tell him someone has broken into the missile room. Wait a minute. They wake up Karan? Why is he sleeping at the control room? Isn't he supposed to be on watch?
He had a little too much to drink.
Okay.
He does the same thing in the Go Lion episode. Yeah. He's just kind of taking a nap.
So as the team watches on a video surveillance monitor, they see Twyla planted a time bomb, and Hunk tells Keith, "Yeah, you were right about Twyla."
Sorry.
Go ahead. Sorry. You want to say something here?
Sorry, I almost beat you up there, boss. Yeah, it turns out you were right. I'm a dumbass.
Yeah. So they only have like 30 seconds left, and nobody knows what to do. But luckily, with Karan's quick thinking, he launches the rocket she placed the bomb on, and the bomb explodes in the sky above the castle. So luckily, she placed the bomb on a rocket.
Well, it doesn't look like a rocket. It doesn't look like much of anything. It just it's just a piece of equipment.
Yeah, but it's sort of folded into the rocket casing and then shot off as they launched it.
And you know, in the Voltron version, I think Karan says something like, "Oh, luckily she put it on a rocket launcher." In the Go Lion version, he totally redeems himself for being asleep at the wheel there.
Because
they're like, "Oh my God, we have 30 seconds and we're all going to die. We can't. It's too late to do anything." And Rybal, his name in Go Lion, doesn't say a word. He just reaches over and hits one button and ejects the thing from the castle.
Right. So in this case, he saved the day.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. It's Rybal and the mice.
So yeah, it's not always the Voltron force.
And I tell you, if it were me, I would be breeding those mice. Want as many of them as you could get.
Can't even tell which ones are female though.
Oh, they know.
So.
Oh, and you know, they name one in Go Lion. They call him Platt, Platt, Platt.
Right.
And so, I mean, I guess the individual mice have names there.
Right. And Keith doesn't know how to talk to the mice, but he just knows something's wrong.
Well, yeah. And there's some narration in the Go Lion episodes that we don't get in Voltron. And at one point, the narrator just flat tells you, Lisa is clairvoyant.
Right.
And that's how she knows the Voltron force is sleeping. But Kogane, which is the Keith character, still harboring some doubts, senses Lisa's presence.
Right.
So I guess they could, I guess he could feel it when she was poking around in their heads a little bit.
Right. So at this point, after the bomb goes off, Hunk goes after her on horseback because she's darted away from the castle. So he's saying she's a spy for Zarkon and she looked like such a nice girl.
Yeah.
Well, on Doom, Zarkon calls the spy a fool for being detected and placing the bomb where it could be detonated harmlessly. Hagar admits she wasn't cut out for evil and feared that from the start. But she wants to turn adversity to advantage by having Zarkon attack while the Voltron force is scouring the land looking for Twyla.
Yeah, that actually makes sense.
Yeah, taking advantage of a bad situation. So as Hunk gets near Twyla, she uses a ray from her eyes to knock Hunk off of his horse. Hunk says, "Stop, I just want to hear it from you. Are you really working for Zarkon and why?"
Yeah, and you know, that's the part that I think they must have had some idea of the original plot, of the original script going into this, because in both versions, Twyla/Lisa mentions that her brother has volunteered to get made into a Robeast in order to free the rest of the slaves. And how, like, there is no reason, based on the visuals here, to think that this Robeast has anything to do with her.
Right, exactly, if you were just basing it on that. But she tells Hunk, if I do as Zarkon commands, he's promised to free all of her enslaved people.
Right.
And Hunk tells her, you're wrong.
Yeah.
Zarkon cannot be trusted. He'll never free those slaves, never. And she tells Hunk, Commander Urak is on his way with her brother. Her brother, as part of the deal, agreed to be turned into a huge, monstrous claw beast. The Robeast coffin flies over both of them as she begs him to go and save himself before it's too late. So at least she has some sense of honor, I guess, in a way, to want to protect Hunk.
Yeah, yeah. And she's a little bit more pragmatic in the Golion version because she says, even if they just free one or two slaves, it'll be worth me selling my soul to the devil, more or less.
Right, right. So as Urak's ship activates the coffin, Urak commands the Claw Beast to destroy Aris. The Claw Beast has two horns coming out of its head with only one eye, like a cyclops, and a beak with teeth. Its fingers are sharp claws, and he carries a ball and chain. All of a sudden, there are Arusians running and screaming away from the Claw Beast. Now, as the Claw Beast uses the ball and chain to crash buildings, Keith gets Hunk on the comm and tells them to report back to the castle, and the Voltron force leave for their alliance.
Mm-hmm.
We all know what's going to happen next. The big action scene with Voltron fighting the Robeast.
There's not so much action to begin with, though. I mean, the lions, you know, we've seen the lions. They're festooned with weapons. They can, you know, manifest these, like, energy-to-matter creation constructs. And they just kind of run up and look at the Robeast and let him beat up on them for a while.
Yeah, they attack the Robeast as it throws its ball and chain at the group. And he's able to wrap Blue Lion in the chain and spin it around its head. And the spinning is tearing the princess and Blue Lion apart. And she calls for help from Keith and Black Lion. And Keith shoots a rocket that breaks her loose and sends Blue Lion crashing to the ground. But she's okay. She's okay. It's just a scratch. So Hunk joins the team and they form Voltron. And then they form Blazing Sword. The Claw Beast attacks with the ball and chain. And Blazing Sword breaks through the chain, sending the ball exploding to the ground behind Voltron. And we see this kind of a scene a lot in a lot of the Robeast fights and battles and stuff like that,
mm-hmm.
where Voltron is in the foreground and what happened behind him explodes, you know, and it's a good scene. It always works, it seems. So that was those Japanese animators trying to make a good effect out of something where Voltron knows what's going to happen. I mean, he had made his cut and, you know, he's just reacting to what's happening behind him. The Claw Beast then blows something from its mouth that Voltron blocks with his arms. Then Voltron counters with his eye beam at the Claw Beast, causing it to block long enough for Voltron to come crashing down with a Blazing Sword to destroy the Claw Beast, also known as Twyla's brother.
Yeah, and a little bit of debris goes flying past her head.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, oh, there's part of my brother.
It's a furious explosion of fire and smoke.
But, you know, if we could back up just a second.
Yeah.
One thing that really struck me about the part of the combat before Hunk showed up and before they combined.
Uh-huh.
In the Voltron version, Allura gets in trouble. She's wrapped up in the flail and is being tossed around. And the rest of the team, especially Pidge, are like, oh, my God, Princess, are you okay? We'll help you. We'll save you. And in the Golion version, this is really early in her tenure as a lion pilot. And it's pretty clear that the rest of the team doesn't respect her very much yet.
Right.
And she's getting slung around by this thing and calling out to her father. And then when she gets broken free, she says, oh, I'm all right. And Pidge says, you're all right. What? You were just calling for your father. Like, you know, just totally like slamming on the princess. Like they don't even really want her there.
Right.
And it's a huge contrast in the way that she's handled.
Yeah. You don't see any of the rest of us calling for our mommy or daddy.
Right.
Yeah. So at this point, we really come to a part where there is a major difference between what happened in Golion and what happened in Voltron.
Ooh, you're not kidding.
So afterwards, at the castle, the people of Aris praise the Voltron force as the princess waves, Karan explains that Twyla has gone back to her planet thanks to Voltron. And Princess gives Lance a kiss for saving her, but Lance says it was Keith, but who's keeping score? And Lance hopes Twyla will get her family back, and Keith assures everyone, oh, she will, because wherever there are forces of evil in the far-flung galaxies, they'll soon be defeated by Voltron, Defender of the Universe. It doesn't end that way in Goline, does it, Dan?
Footage from another episode. That's what all that stuff with kissing Lance on the cheek was, because they had a lot of time to fill. Because, yeah, in the Goline episode, after the giant Cyclops or Obeast gets cut in half, which you see on camera, Hunk has gotten out of the lion and he runs up to the top of a cliff where Lisa is waiting, and he says, I forget his exact words, but he says, we can still work this out. Come back. Join us. Without a word, she steps off the cliff.
Yep.
There's nothing left for her there. So, yeah. There goes Lisa plummeting to her death. The next scene is they've set up a little grave site at the top of the cliff there.
Yeah, at the top of the cliff.
Well, it's messy at the bottom.
So we don't want to take her actual body and bury it wherever, but we're going to do it at the top of the cliff, right?
It's a memorial.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, so they had quite a few, like probably a minute or two to fill there, because they couldn't show any of that in the Voltron episode.
Right.
So, yeah, I think they just grabbed some footage from some other episode and tacked it on there and scripted it in so it would fit, kind of. Yes, Twyla's fine. She went back to her home planet.
Right. So the major difference is that we think in Voltron that Twyla's being controlled by Hagar. Mm-hmm. And in the Goline version, she's actually a clairvoyant psychic who has these powers. Mm-hmm. And then also that she dies at the end, and in the Voltron version, she doesn't.
Right.
So are you ready for episode 10, Secret of the White Lion?
I am if you are.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
Okay, in the Goline title in this one is just called Curse of the White Lion. So I'm not sure why the difference in the one word, secret versus curse, but you might get your own ideas as we go along here.
Right.
So the evil plan of Hagar at the beginning of this episode is described as we see Zarkon on Planet Doom. A white lion she has created will be used to destroy Voltron. She will haunt Allura's dreams, so she will seek out the white lion, not knowing that the lion is part of Hagar's deadly trap. So we see Allura's dream here. She's being chased by drool soldiers, and she gets hit by a laser, and as she falls down, she sees an image of her mother and talks to her mother, seeking guidance for ruling Arrhys. She senses her mother telling her to find the white lion and trust him because he speaks with the wisdom of her father, King Alphor. And as she wakes up from her dream, the space mice try to get her to come too, and she hears a lion's roar. All right, so we're all building up here for something that's going to, you know, affect the whole episode. But there is a little bit of a difference here between Goline and Voltron, right?
Well, yeah. In the dream that she has, number one, when she falls, she looks up and sees the rest of the Voltron team dead, lying there in pools, like expanding pools of blood. And it's in the Voltron episode, she's looking at the specter of her mother, and she's like, oh. Yes, I hear what you're telling me. I need to trust in the words of the White Lion because he's my father. And in the Goline episode, her mother still doesn't say anything, and Allura's just like, can you give me a little help here, Mom? Like, a hint? You know, I need to be an effective ruler. I need to know how to be a warrior. You're not going to say anything, huh? thanks, Mom.
Yeah, she doesn't say a word. And
nope. And no message conveyed.
And I think it's a much more dramatic feeling that Allura has as she sees all of her dead comrades.
Oh, yeah.
That definitely has to have affected her a lot more, and you don't see that on the Voltron version.
Right.
She hears her father's voice speaking to her as he is reborn as the White Lion. She chases after his voice. "I'm coming, father," with the space mice following. And when she gets to the balcony of the castle looking across the lake, she sees a large white lion image floating in front of her. And the lion says in Alfor's voice, "If you would become a truly great leader, follow me into the forest." And she goes, "Yes, yes." So he says, "I will share royal secrets that will make planet Eris strong again." And Allura says, "Father, with your wisdom and guidance, I can't fail." So she's getting ready to leave the castle, still in her night robes. Two of the castle guards try to stop her, and she commands them to let her go. "I'm coming, father." They think she's gone mad.
Worst guards ever.
Yeah. They think she's gone mad because her father's dead. And then she goes to meet the white lion in the forest.
Yeah.
How can they let her go?
Those guys are not winning any Employee of the Month awards.
Yeah, worst guards on earth. I agree with you. She follows the white lion to a waterfall where Hagar and the cat, Kova, is what it's called in the Voltron version, are waiting. And Hagar cackles about how easy it was to trick Allura with the white lion.
Okay, I've been trying to reconcile this plan of Hagar's in my own mind. Why does she need the actual lion? You know, if she's able to invade Allura's dreams and get her to come out into the middle of nowhere in the forest, and Hagar is just standing there?
Right.
Why doesn't Hagar then shoot her?
Exactly. I mean, why didn't she just have the lion attack her?
I don't think it's necessary to have the actual lion there, but maybe that's just me being a picky writer again.
Well, as we see later, even though she has evil intentions, she still has a bigger plan going on here. So meanwhile, in the castle, Nanny is looking for Allura and shouting her name. One of the guards that let her go from the castle said she went out into the forest calling for her father. And Nanny thinks if anything happens to the princess, Aris is completely doomed. So apparently the guards didn't think that.
Right.
So she sounds the alarm. And immediately, Karan and the team to get together with Nanny, and she asks, why would the princess go into the forest in the middle of the night?
In her nightgown.
Right. Karan is clueless. The rest of the team thinks she might want exercise or some crazy story they can think of. Karan says something is wrong. This isn't like her at all. And he wants an immediate search. So the team head for the lions. Hagar sees the lions looking for the princess, and she thinks this is better than she had planned. Soon she will have all of them. And Lance spots Princess near the waterfall. Lance gets out of Red Lion, tells Princess to move out of the way so he can shoot the lion. She gets in front of the lion, tells him not to shoot because the lion is the spirit of her father. So what do you think Lance is thinking at this point?
Not much of Allura, I'm afraid. In fact, in the Golion, they're even less sympathetic than they are in the Voltron version. And the only real difference is that Allura believes that it's her mother in the lion.
The whole time.
There is never any mention of her father.
Right.
And that does make sense, since even in the Voltron version, later on, she sees her mother's face superimposed over the lion's face.
Mm-hmm.
This whole episode is just kind of bizarre to me. I didn't remember seeing it when I was doing research for the comics, and I was just kind of scratching my head the whole time.
Well, I think it shows that she's still very gullible. She still has a lot of faith in her father to help her through things instead of just doing it herself. And she's still holding on to her parents somehow.
That's true. And the whole time I'm also thinking, why didn't they land the lions down there where the princess was?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Let's put this huge cliff in between us here.
All right.
I'm sorry. I'm being picky.
So here's what Lance thinks in the Voltron version. Lance thinks if it was really her father, he wouldn't have advised her to go out into the forest in the middle of a night in her nightgown with a lion. I mean, I love the way Lance just comes out and says it, you know? And he comes down the hill, and the lion blows some pink material out his mouth that encircles Lance, tying him up.
It's a net beam.
Yes, a net beam. And Keith, Pidge, and Hunk arrive just in time. They get out of the lines, come down the hill with their blasters drawn. Pidge fires a shot at the lion, who gets out of the way. The lion then wraps Pidge in the same pink netting that flies from its mouth. And as Hunk comes down the hill firing at the lion, Keith warns him about the net rays, but Hunk gets caught in them too. So now we got three guys tied up in the net rays, and Keith is the only one that's free, and Alora's still, she's worthless right now.
Yeah, I really hate to see, the main character in my Terminator series is female. And I wanted to make a female who was capable of believably going toe-to-toe with a Terminator. And a lot of the characters that I've written over the years have been really good, competent female characters. And I see Allura being written this way, and it's really frustrating. Because you're right, she's kind of just worthless at this point.
Well, I mean, obviously, as the more episodes happen, the stronger she gets, the more sure of herself she becomes.
Yeah.
As the pilot of Blue Lion, as a member of the Voltron Force, as a leader of Aris, you know, it's just a shame to see her this way.
Well, that's true. But I mean, there's a lack of experience, and then there's, you know, maybe she could be looking at this white lion spewing glowing pink net beams at her teammates and think, perhaps this is not my mother. It's not a big leap.
Right. It's not. But at this point, Keith is running up the hill to try to get back to the black lion, but the white lion blocks his path. He fires at the lion and goes back down and then disappears. So the white lion can't find him. So he goes back to the princess, and the others are like, hey, get out of the way. Get out of the way. He's going to get you. And she faints.
Yeah, to add insult to injury, she faints.
Yeah. So Hagar has all the tied up pilots now, sitting Indian style, tied up to three poles in front of Allura, who's tied to a cross, crucifixion style.
Yeah.
And Keith is watching from afar as Hagar calls out to him, saying, you'll soon fall into my trap. So their helmets are sitting in front of each of the pilots as they're sitting Indian style, tied to these poles. She's up on a cross. This is really strange. What is Hagar's move here? Why would she do that?
I have no idea. This is everything about what she's doing is so needlessly elaborate.
Mm-hmm.
If she wants to get rid of the Voltron Force, why keep them captive at all? As soon as they're helpless, shoot them.
Well, here's what I thought. They're right near a lake or a river.
Yeah,
And this is sort of on the beach. What I thought, she was going to wait for some tide to come across and get them.
Oh, yeah.
And she was going to be like Dr. Evil and just think, oh, well, I'm just going to leave and everything's going to go according to plan. You know, why worry about it? But no, she has something else in mind. Hagar turns the white lion into a two-legged roe beast with a lion's head. And at this point, it's just regular man-sized, a little bit larger than your normal man.
Mm-hmm.
But Hagar tells the lion roe beast to finish them off, and they'll never trouble us again. So the roe beast pulls out a sword, and Keith fires on it with his blaster. The roe beast goes after Keith, and you can see it's about, at this point, about twice the size of Keith. They battle, but up in the sky, everyone sees Blue Lion coming towards them. They all wonder who's flying it because it looks rather shaky. Well, it's Karan flying, and Nanny's also in the cockpit. And Kranz suggests they try a lever in the cockpit, but Nanny hits the wrong one. And it sends thousands of gallons of water spewing from Blue Lion's mouth all over the people on the ground. And it washes away Hagar and her cat, and the princess, who's still tied to the cross, gets washed away too. Well, the three guys on the poles are still there. So this is all just going completely crazy at this point.
It's so weird.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've got the Roe Beast who's like, oh crap, my witch, I gotta go save Hagar. And Keith does the exact same thing, goes after Allura.
They both jump into the water. The Roe Beast goes after Hagar while Keith puts a knife in his mouth, and we're not sure how he's going to use it yet, but it's pretty obvious when he gets there. He dives into the water. He cuts the ropes and saves the princess. Okay. Karan and Nanny land Blue Lion and come after the others. Well, they sort of crash landed. But Urak's forces arrive, and they beam up the Roe Beast and Hagar. They squabble a bit, but she tells them to energize the Roe Beast with the infra-energizer beam. The Roe Beast grows as high as a mountain. So the team goes to their lines to face the Roe Beast, setting up an attack formation. And they fire missiles on it from all directions. And then the princess says she's the one that got them into this trouble in the first place. She should be the one to get the Roe Beast. So in Blue Lion, she heads down to make her attack. And as you said before, the lion's head turns into her mother's head, throwing her off guard. She pulls up and gets caught in the hair of the mane of the lion Roe Beast.
Yes, yes, which is apparently prehensile.
Yeah. So you...
Because that makes sense.
So as this gets crazier and crazier, yeah. She gets fooled once again. After she says, I'm the one who got everybody into this mess. I'm the one who's going to get us out. And then she gets fooled again. I'm not really sure why she keeps on getting fooled. But at this point, Allura keeps crying mother while all the lions go after this lion with their mouth weapons so they can cut into the hair of the mane to try to get her loose.
Princess, will you get it into your head? That's not your father or your mother. It's Hagar's witchcraft.
It seems so real.
And the lions fly through the lion's mane and cut Blue Lion free. And then they form Voltron. Then they form Blazing Sword. And they cut the Roe Beast in one swipe.
And it's not really very different in the Go Lion version. The bizarre elements of the episode are still right there. I mean, the Voltron version complicates it a little bit by making the White Lion the spirit of her father, she thinks,
right,
instead of just her mother. But she gets taken in by the magical ruse. She gets caught in the worst hair day ever. Allura's the one who has to overcome the illusion. And there is a little bit of growth there at the end where she says, I can't wait for people to come and rescue me. I'm basically going to have to start looking out for myself, making my own decisions. And that was good. That was nice to see.
The team had joined together at Allura's mother's gravesite.
Yeah.
And Keith tells her, this is where your mother is, and your father's in the tomb in the castle. And she wanted to believe that they had returned to help her. But Nanny suggests she no longer fly Blue Lion because of how she is. But she insists that she must no longer look for help from those who are gone.
Yeah, at that point, Nanny is, she's like, okay, you don't fly Blue Lion anymore. Karan and I have got it handled. And Karan just nods. He's like, yeah, that sounds like a great idea. And it's exactly the same in Go Lion.
Yeah, the only one who says anything good is Pidge, because, I mean, he basically says, well, you guys stink at this, all right?
Right.
I'd much rather have Allura in there than you guys, even if she's going bat crazy. So, yeah, I thought that was pretty funny. So that's the end of that episode. And we move on to episode 11, which in the Voltron, it's called Surrender. And in Go Lion, it's called Red Rain of Hell.
Voltron will be back after these messages.
And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
All right, so episode 11, Surrender. And in the Go line, it's called Red Rain of Hell. So I understand why they changed the name for Voltron.
Yeah.
And the Surrender actually gives away a lot of the plot.
Yeah, it's true.
It really does. On the Voltron version, it starts off a little bit different than the Go line version. They actually explain what the plan is a little bit before you see what's going on. On Doom, Zarkon asks if he has anything that can defeat Voltron, because they haven't been able to do it yet. And Hagar says she will destroy Aris once and for all. She's cast a magic spell that will make a red rain fall on the planet. And Zarkon is pleased. He will destroy Aris and Voltron and never have to leave home. So he's just happy he didn't have to get out of bed to do this, you know?
A good emperor is a lazy emperor, I always say.
Yeah, but in the Gold Lion version, it starts off with the next scene where on Aris, all is peaceful. And I guess in the Gold Lion version, it's called Altia.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
And so, I think it's a lot creepier just to start with the atmospheric weirdness,
right?
With no explanation before it.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's a little bit more dramatic that way. All is peaceful, and then in the sky grows dark and red, and all the inhabitants are scared. They've never seen a red rain before. And then Allura remarks about how her picnic will be canceled, and Karan says the red rain might be Zarkon's work, and Allura seems surprised. Well, in Golion, a lot goes on here that we don't get to see in the Voltron version, right?
Yeah, yeah, well... Allura has another, I don't know, is it politically incorrect to call it a blonde moment?
Oh, I don't know, but
it probably is, but she's looking out at the rain and she's like, oh, it's so pretty. It looks just like strawberry juice. And I think it's Karan that says, it's not strawberry juice, princess, it's human blood.
and what happens when this human blood falls on the people in the towns?
Well, it's not really human blood unless it's human blood that's been mixed with kerosene, because it ignites. It all of a sudden everything catches fire. And in the Golion version, we get to see quite a few Arusians burn to death.
Yeah, that's a little bit more scary, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, like there's the one guy who's sort of like the doomsday prophet, and he's out there going, oh, this will spell the end of us all, and it certainly spells the end of him.
Well, now we know why Allura seems so surprised in the Voltron version, because she didn't think it was that bad at all.
Right. It's Zarkon's work, what? Yeah, it's a little different from, oh, human blood, huh?
Yeah. So, as the ground becomes drenched with the redness... it turns into a fire, and the Voltron Force thinks it's Hagar's doing. They all stand around in horror, gazing at this. Then Allura says the freedom of Aris is at stake, and they head to the lions. So a river of fire is actually running through the countryside. So Keith tells Pidge and Allura to go down and help the people, while Hunk, Lance, and Keith cause a landslide to try to make it a natural dam.
Completely ineffectively.
It's not working too well. Pidge and Allura try to keep the people from panicking and trampling over each other. As the red rain continues to fall and the flames go higher and hotter, Keith thinks about an ice grid. And Allura hops back in Blue Lion. Pidge gets back to Green Lion, but he's got a new person with him. He's got the daughter of someone who got separated from her mother. So... Allura uses Blue Lion to make an ice grid to try to stop the river of flames, but it goes right through it. The fire just melts the ice.
Again, completely ineffective.
Right. Nothing that they're doing is helping with this. The only thing that they've been able to do is to try to get the people to higher ground.
I mean, this is the by far the most effective weapon that the Drools have dispatched to Era so far.
Right. Right, and it seems to be working really well for Planet Doom.
Mm-hmm.
Green Lion uses the Tornado Blaster, but it doesn't seem to work either. What he tried to do was he tried to get a tornado of fire to go up as he goes up higher, and it just didn't seem to work at all. Well, Yurak is pleased that they have them on the run. So he sends out one of his robot soldiers who's programmed to obey him and go after the Voltron force. And as the crowd of people find higher ground, they all look down on their burning valley, and Princess wonders what will become of Aris. Lightning starts affecting Hunk and Lance's lions. Then Yurak's ship uses their tractor beams to pull the lions up towards his ship. So the lions are all dragged into the other lions as they all crash against each other. And Yurak tells his robot soldier to broaden the ray to take as many captives as they can of the people that are standing on the hill. The tractor beam pulls hundreds of people into Yurak's ship all at once as his ship lands. They send out robot ships to go get the Voltron force. Anything different here in the Golion version so far?
It's pretty similar. It's pretty similar. One thing that just, it's not related to the story, just I felt like remarking on, I really have to wonder about some of the voice choices that they make, because particularly the little girl. In Voltron, is her name Tammy, I think?
Yeah.
And in Golion, they call her Fran, which is just as good. But in Golion, she sounds like a little girl. And her voice in the Voltron episode is just weird. It doesn't even begin to cover it. Just kind of made me cringe. And I don't know why so many times American cartoons feel the need to have the kinds of voices that do not occur in nature.
Ah.
Okay. You know, again, this may just be me being picky, but it was distracting. Like having to listen to the voice that they gave this girl, particularly when I knew that in Golion she just sounded like a little girl, it took me out of the story. Like I didn't care so much what happened to her and around her because her voice was so annoying. But, you know, I'm grumpy.
All right. Well, after the lions had crashed together, they fell to the ground and nobody was moving. Karan and Nanny try to reach them, but there's no answer. So these drool ships attack the lions, and the lions get up and start attacking the robot ships with proton missiles. Well, the lions are holding their own against the robot ships, knocking them out of the sky. Yurak shows the Voltron force their prisoners and asks them if they're willing to sacrifice an entire village because they won't give up.
Space explorers, look at these poor frightened captives. Are you ready to sacrifice an entire village because you won't give up? Have you no heart? You must surrender.
So this is where surrender comes into play here.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Hunk thinks they're bluffing. But the princess thinks there's too many lives at stake, and Keith makes the decision to surrender. Now, in Golion, that's not how it happens, right?
Well, the drools make their point by shooting a guy. And, of course, in Voltron, you hear someone say, "That was only a stun gun. Next time we'll set to kill," or something like that. And in Golion, you know, very few punches get pulled. So that guy's just dead.
Right. Right. They actually kill somebody to make their point.
Executed a hostage, yes.
So the princess tells Karan to run up the white flag of surrender. Now, I think in the Golion verse, she was the only one who made that choice. Whereas in this one, it makes like Keith made the decision before her to do it. Is that right?
I think that's right.
Okay. You know, in this case, she's making the decision for the people of Aris. At this point, she doesn't know what to do. But Pidge has an idea, and he needs the little girl's help to pull it off.
Yeah, this is definitely my favorite part of the episode.
Right. So as the five lions are parked near Yurak's ship, Yurak's robot soldier says the prisoners will be released when they have all the Voltron Force members in custody. Well, Keith doesn't agree to those terms. He says they'll go one at a time as a group of prisoners gets released each time. So meanwhile, the little girl shows up in Pidge's uniform, and that's when the team thinks they have a chance. They're not really sure what Pidge's plan is, but they trust him.
Yeah, they hit the note a little harder in Go Lion because Kogane says, "Well, I don't know what Shorty has in mind here, but let's have faith in him and see what happens."
Right. So as the first exchange happens with a group of prisoners for Keith, then Lance, then Hunk, then the princess, and then at last the little girl acting as Pidge. So as the little girl passes her mother in the last group, her mother recognizes her, then stops to hold her, but then one of the drools fires and it grazes the back of the mother. The team asks for medical assistance, but Pidge starts attacking the soldiers with Green Lion, and the rest of the team fight their captors. Urak's robot runs back to his ship while all of the prisoners are now free and safe.
Yeah, it's a little bit unclear in the Voltron version exactly why the head drool guy there shoots the mother. But in the Go Lion version, it's a good bit clearer, and it's because they have no intention of honoring this prisoner exchange thing. That was just the first shot fired.
Right.
And then the guy says, "Go get all those prisoners back."
His plan was to kill them all, but yeah. He didn't know about Pidge's plan.
Right. Yeah, and Pidge having a plan was really great to see, so we don't have to rely on space mice.
Yeah.
Nanny and Karan to come in and save the day.
And again, it wasn't Voltron who saved the day or the lions or anything like that. It was just Pidge's, you know, mind, you know, coming up with a good plan. So at this point, the whole tide has turned. And the mother's reunited with her little girl. She's okay. It was just a scratch. But Urak releases a robeast that looks like, I don't know, a mountain goat or a buffalo.
Yeah, they call in the Go Lion version, they call it the Buffalon.
I like how they give them names in that one. They don't ever give them names in Voltron.
Yeah, it's like they, you know, they're on a first name basis with these creatures.
Right. So he's got this white furry hair and he looks like, I guess, a buffalo. The team gets back in their lines and they form Voltron right away. The Robeast comes after them and they form Blazing Sword just in time to block the Robeast sword. And after another block and a blow to the Robeast's head, the Robeast fires a couple beams from its chest. Voltron dodges the attack and fires a flame from Red Lion's mouth. The Robeast looks like he's cooked, but fires back again at Voltron, who blocks them with the Blazing Sword. Voltron releases the Electro Cross from his chest plate, and it hits the Robeast on the forehead. Then, while he's stunned, Blue Lion bites his leg, and Blazing Sword finishes the job after stabbing the Robeast. And after the Robeast explodes, Urak retreats once again. Another good exchange between the Robeast and Voltron again here at the end to finish the episode. And then there's one little scene at the end where, as the team says goodbye to the little girl and her mother at the castle, Pidge says she reminds him of his little sister back with the space explorers on planet Kara. So is that sort of how it ended with Go Lion?
Yeah, I believe so. There wasn't quite as much interchange. There was a lot more conversation in the Voltron version where the little girl is saying, you know, "I'm going to be a space explorer. Size doesn't matter. You know, you can be a little person and still have a big impact." And in Go Lion, she and her mom really just say, "Okay, thanks, guys. Bye."
All right, so now we come to the last episode that we're reviewing this week, and it's episode 12, Bad Birthday Party, as it's called in Voltron, and Evil Doing of the Emperor, as it's called on Go Lion.
Voltron will be back after these messages. And now, back to Voltron, Defender of the Universe.
So on Planet Nemone, and this was something I had to actually physically sort of write out the name of the planet here in sort of, I don't know how it was supposed to be spelled, but Nemone, I had to, at the end, I had M-O-A-N so that I would know to to say moan, you know? Because this is a really strange name for a planet, but Planet Nemone, they are speeding up production of the mineral pneumonium.
Right.
And it is vital in the Majesty's superior war machine, as they call it. All who fail to meet their quotas will be severely punished. And King Zarkon is supposed to visit on his birthday, so they're preparing a magnificent celebration. Everything must be perfect. So the captain and soldiers are making sure workers are meeting their quotas. Now there's a man named Prince Tabor, who is described as the nephew of Zarkon. Prince Tabor is pleased that they are meeting the quotas for pneumonium and that the statue of Zarkon will be ready for his birthday. And the captain tells Prince Tabor that he is solely responsible for all this progress. Now, in the Golion version, they don't mention that he's the nephew of Zarkon at all, right? He's just a...
He's the viceroy.
Right.
Yeah. There you go. Yeah. This episode differs, I think, more than the others that we've been talking about from Voltron differs from this. And I'm not sure what the intended age range was for the original Golion, but right. whatever it was, it got a lot higher with this episode.
Well, I think whenever you're talking about slaves being like whipped and, you know, being treated poorly because they're made to work all the time and you know, they're wearing them to death. You know, they don't really care what happens to these slaves at all.
It gets a lot worse than that, though.
Yeah, I know. We're going to get to that.
Yeah. But yeah, there's you see several scenes of the whips actually connecting with people. Like the brutality is very much on camera in the Golion version.
Right, and the slave workers, when they do get a break, they're made to eat scraps that are just bones. One slave says they need Voltron, the other says Voltron is millions of miles away on Eris. So while they're eating these bones and stuff like that, there's two other characters that aren't eating, but are talking about how to get out of this situation. But it's not just bones, is it?
Oh,
Golion.
Oh, yeah, that's... that. as my father might say, Lordy, Lordy. That's a heaping helping of cannibalism right there is what that is, because the guards come in and say, here, gnaw on the bones of your friends. And it's really clearly human bones with chunks of meat still attached.
Yeah.
And so that's, and boy, they tuck in too. Like everyone except these two boys that are like the protagonists of this particular story.
Yeah.
All the guys who all look exactly alike. They're all, it's a bunch of bald white dudes.
Right.
But yeah, they're like, ooh, food, you know.
They don't care what it is.
They don't care that, oh, I think that's Carl. You know, that's my buddy Jerry. They're just like, oh, yep, we're hungry. We're going to eat some dudes.
And the two boys can't believe they're so accepting of this.
Right.
Yeah, so the one worker's name in Voltron is called Jai. And he says he's got to get the Voltron force there to help them. And the other, Tal, says that that's just a nice dream. You know, this isn't... Are you kidding? How are we going to get Voltron here? There's no way.
Right.
But Jai says... He'll go get them in a spaceship. And he points to the launch dock and says there's always a couple spaceships ready to go from there. And tonight, when they're all getting ready for Zarkon's visit tomorrow, I'll sneak down there, grab one, and take off. And Tal just thinks, well, that's a nice dream, but it's not really going to happen. So the Drool soldiers are having a feast, and they're telling the wenches to bring them food and nectar and be quick about it. And the captain gives a toast to King Zarkon. There's a little bit more happening in Golion, right?
Well, yeah. At the same time, there's less happening, though, because, number one, well, like you already mentioned, the Viceroy is no relation to Zarkon.
Right.
Which is just baffling to me that anyone would want to make him Zarkon's nephew, because Zarkon is who he is, and the Viceroy is a Caucasian human guy. But right. but there's also no mention of any sort of mineral mining in the Golion episode. Everything that the workers are doing is strictly about that monument. And the monument is a big deal because in the birthday angle is the same in both episodes, and it's Zarkon's 500th birthday.
Right.
So the dude is old.
Uh-huh.
And it's more than just they're going to have a party. They are having a feast in preparation for the grand unveiling of the monument, but the soldiers there are drinking like fish and getting sloppy drunk, and there's quite a bit of some physical forwardness with the serving ladies.
Yeah, they're going after the women who are slaves there.
Yeah, yeah, and thankfully there's not too much of that on camera, but there is definitely enough so that you have zero doubt as to what's going on.
Right, you get the idea. So at this point, as Jai's looking at them doing their feast, he goes down to the launch dock, steals a ship, and takes off like he said he was going to do. The soldiers realize that someone has stolen a slave shuttle. The captain calls for pursuit ships to stop him, or King Zarkon will be furious. So Jai must face a meteor shower, and then the pursuit ships are firing lasers that hit his ship. Now, his ship is on fire, spiraling out of control. What does this remind you of? Does it remind you of when the original space explorers escaped from Planet Doom?
Yeah.
Well, every ship that is in trouble and spiraling out of control eventually lands on Eris, right?
Well, you know, it makes a lot more sense in the Golion version why he was able to get to Eris. Because in Voltron, they make a big deal out of how far away Nemon is.
Right.
And in Golion, the name of the planet is Jara. And they explain that Jara is actually the closest planet to Eris. But that that meteor field is this huge barrier. And it's like this... I guess sort of an electromagnetic storm in space kind of thing.
Right.
But that's the reason why it's tough to get there. But once the kid does make it through, that's why Eris is his next stop, is because it's actually a really close trip.
Yeah. So Jai and his out of control ship crash land in the lake next to the Castle of Lions on Eris, and the Voltron force, they see the man in the water and they go to help him. So here we are, another case where there's a stranger from outside the planet who crash lands on Eris, and they're immediately helping him.
It made me laugh in the Voltron version too, because the kid crashes and he's either been thrown from the wreckage or he's climbed out and he's in the moat around the castle or the body of water near there. And he's floating on his face. He's just like, looks like a dead body in the water. And you pan over, and all five members of the Voltron Force are just standing there looking at him. You know, just like, huh, there's a guy in the water. And in the Golion version, I forget who, someone says, I thought for sure that was another enemy attack.
Mm-hmm.
Guess not. And Kogane says, yeah, okay, let's fish him out.
So it's a lot less of a worrisome event, isn't it?
Well, yeah. Just in the Voltron version, you know, it's like, okay, let's go down to the moat and watch the drowning victim. That's a good evening's entertainment.
Meanwhile, Prince Tabor is meeting with the Drool captain, and he's furious that he let a slave escape in a ship. The captain refuses to take the blame. He said it was just as much Prince Tabor's responsibility. The captain thinks he knows how to handle it, and he whispers his idea in the prince's ear. Well, that's all we get to see from that. We don't get to see anything else, so we have no idea what the captain's idea was.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the next day, the captain tells the rest of the workers their comrade was foolish to try to escape. They will never see him again. He tells them their would-be hero was shot out of the sky by their attack force, and Tal blames himself for letting Jai do it. So it appears his idea was to just tell all the other workers that he didn't escape, but he got shot down. So that if any of them try to do it, that's what's going to happen to them, right?
Yeah, yeah. And he gets a little more grim in the Golion version, because he goes on to tell them you're all going to work on this project until you die.
Okay.
How's that for motivation?
So no chance of getting out of here, even if we get all the pneumonium they need, right?
Right.
All right. But in this case, I guess in the Go Lion version, it was just until that statue was done.
Right.
On Doom, Zarkon is recalling when he captured Nemon and making their people his slaves because he needed the valuable minerals. Now, he knows of Jai's escape, and if Jai reaches the Voltron Force, the mighty robot will come to their aid. He knew he should have never put his nephew in charge of the planet Nemon. So he seeks help from Hagar. She offers no magical help, just that he should torture 100 slaves to teach them a lesson to never try to escape. So Zarkon rallies his forces as they begin their journey to Nemo. So this is really the first time that we see Zarkon going with his forces to any of these places, right?
Yeah, it's kind of a less dramatic thing in Go Lion, because he knows that he's going to go to Jara to celebrate his 500th birthday, and he knows that they've got this massive monument there. He doesn't seem all that happy about it, though. He says something like, I really never thought I'd be spending my birthday on Jara. Oh, well. All right, let's go.
Yeah, the difference is here, it's still a birthday thing.
Mm-hmm.
They're honoring him with the statue. But in this one, he's checking on the progress of the pneumonium. And he's also getting to see the statue.
Right. Yeah, the statue is just kind of a bonus, whereas it's the whole point in the Go Lion.
So on Aris, the team is trying to figure out where the fellow that crash-landed came from. And as Nanny brings him some food, it appears her voice is a little bit different in the Voltron version. I didn't understand that. It didn't sound like Nanny when I was watching it. But he wakes up, and he refuses the food that they're bringing. He says he can't eat while his people are starving. So he came to get help for his desperate planet. And Allura tells him he has to rest and build up his strength, but Jai says there's no time. Every minute they waste could mean a life. So Keith comes in, and they identified the ship as Zarkon's. If he needs their help, he's got it. So that's the end of that. We're going to help them, just like that.
Yeah.
Was it the same on Golion?
Not at all. Because Allura does tell the kid that she's sure that Voltron can free his people and set everything right. But then they go and you see them looking at the star map, and it's explained that there's this massive barrier, this massive energy barrier between the two planets. And Kogane says, yeah, we're not going. We can't. We can't do it. It's impossible. And the kid comes up and hears them saying this, and he's brokenhearted, and he says, did you just lie to me? Did you just lie to my face? You're not going to come and help me? Bunch of lying liars. And Allura says, okay, I'm going. If I have to go alone, I'm going. And everyone but Kogane says, yeah, we're going to go too. So there's a pretty good amount of tension between the rest of the team and the chief, as they call him.
Right. And then that whole scene, as it works out on Voltron, is they're looking on the space monitor to see what kind of trip it is to Nemon. Keith says it's far and dangerous, filled with magnetic fields, black holes, and meteors. And he said they would be leaving Aris undefended. And maybe it's a trick by Zarkon to lead them away. And that's when Jai comes in and tells him it's no trick. His people need help. Voltron's the only one that can save them. Princess says she needs to consult with her advisor. Jai says, my people are being tortured and starved, and you want to talk? We have nowhere left to turn. And that's when Allura believes him, and they decide to. So Zarkon arrives on Nemon with Urak and Hagar. Prince Tabor greets him. Zarkon likes the statue, and Tabor tells him he's been making the slaves work triple time to mine more pneumonium. Now, as they're walking, Zarkon notices he's walking over the bodies of the slaves and says, what have we here? Well, what do we have here? Is it the same on Golion?
This is where this episode gets particularly dark. I mean, leaving aside the tasty cannibalism from earlier, because Zarkon, I mean, he's a bad guy. He's like a sadistic, disturbed individual, and this is not like a bad guy for a cartoon. He's just a bad guy by any standards,
right?
Because like he's commenting on how nice it feels to walk here along the backs of all these slaves, but he's the viceroy says, "So check out the monument. What do you think?" And he says, Zarkon says, "I like the monument. Monument's good. I don't like all these people that built it, though. They're ugly. They offend me."
He doesn't like the idea. It was people that he doesn't like that built this statue up to him.
Right, right. So he wants to get rid of them, but killing them would be boring. Let's do something more creative. And he says that they're going to paint the desert red, and it gets serious.
Right. So in the Voltron version, though, that after he says, "What have we here?" and Tabor says, "Oh, nothing, sire. Just slaves who are tired and lazy, claiming to be sick and injured." And Zarkon laughs and says, "No excuses. Work." And Zarkon confronts his nephew about the slave that escaped. The prince says he was destroyed. Zarkon says, "You better hope so. Nothing better interfere with my plans." And Zarkon says, "Let's teach these slaves a lesson." So, meanwhile, the Voltron force head to their lines. Jai rides with Pidge. They form Voltron in space. Voltron has to ride through a magnetic field and a meteor storm. Meteor hits them, knocking them down. Keith tells them to use thermoblasters to melt the meteors. So they do that. And on Nemon, Zarkon asks Tabor if they've prepared everything for the slaves he will make an example of. Hagar says, "Aren't slaves buried up to their necks in sands a delightful sight?" So that's what he has. He has all these slaves buried in the sands, and the only thing you can see is their heads.
Well, if we could back up just a little bit, when the team is gathering, when they're about to get into the shuttles to go out to the lions, and Keith is the last one to arrive. In the Voltron episode, it's all full of pep and energy and such, and Lance throws a punch at Keith, and Keith catches the punch, and he's like, "Oh, save that energy for the bad guys," or whatever it is he says. And in the Go Lion, Keith is the one who didn't want to go. And when he shows up, everyone else is still openly defiant. And that punch is not just boyish exuberance. That's Lance throwing a punch at Kogane.
And that doesn't happen very often.
No. But I like how nonchalantly Kogane catches the punch, like it's just nothing. But he says, "Okay, fine. I've been outvoted 4-1. Okay, let's go."
Mm-hmm.
But then once they're fighting their way through the energy field, at one point, Hothead says something like, "Oh, these meteors are going to tear us apart." And Kogane says, "Would you shut up and quit complaining? You knew it would be like this."
Yeah.
Like, you're the one that wanted to go, you know, quit bitching.
Yeah. So we're on Nemon here, and they're showing all these slaves with their heads sticking out of the sand. And Zarkon says, "Because one of you tried to escape, my robot soldiers will practice their swordplay and teach you a lesson." It's not exactly what Dibazal said in Go Lion, was it?
No, he said, "Now we're going to have some head hunting. And whoever harvests the most heads and brings them to me will get a prize."
Yeah, that's pretty dark and dismal for these slaves in the Go Lion version.
It's a kid's show.
Yeah. So at just the right moment, Voltron arrives on Nemon as the soldiers are starting to go after the slaves. Voltron spotted to Zarkon's surprise, and Voltron forms Blazing Sword. So Voltron ends up going after Zarkon's statue, cuts off part of it, and this causes Zarkon to fall out of his seat. Then Voltron finishes the job by knocking down the rest of the statue. As Zarkon tries to escape to his ship, Tal gets out of the sand. Voltron lands, and Tal sees Jai is alive, and they're very happy to see each other. So Jai gets lowered down, and he says, "I did it, didn't I?" Tal says, "You sure did." So as Zarkon's ship takes off, Voltron follows, and Zarkon thinks he's too close for comfort. So Hagar uses her special magic to make Voltron burn up, and Urak energizes two Robeasts, two this time. They both have shields and swords, and what ends up happening is Voltron's blue lion bites the leg of one, while yellow lion bites the leg of the other, and they both tumble down and land on buildings on the surface. So we're talking about two Robeasts. That's never happened before.
And there's a couple of things that happen in the Voltron episode that aren't really, that are kind of strange, that have good explanations, When Jai gets out of the ship, when Jai reunites with his buddy, he's holding these two bundles. And what I believe that is he's brought food back. Because in the Voltron episode, when they're trying to nurse him back to health, he says, "I can't eat when my people are starving."
Right.
In the Golion episode, he says, "Can I take this food back to Jara?"
Yeah.
Because my people are starving. So I think that those two mysterious bundles that he's holding are—he's brought a takeout.
Yeah, because he didn't want to eat his friends.
Right. Yeah. take out food from Eris for his buddy, so they don't have to eat fried thigh meat.
Yeah. I got Chinese. You like rice?
Right. One thing that the Voltron episode put in that shouldn't have been. At one point, the twin Robeasts throw their shields, and I guess they do kind of look like flying saucers, because it's really clear that they throw their shields.
Right.
But then Hunk says, "Doom ship coming in at 7 o'clock."
Ah.
I don't know who was or was not paying attention to that.
Right. Well, the Robeast launches the shield at Voltron. Lance blocks it. Then the Robeast launches missiles and it hits Voltron.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other Robeast comes down with his sword on Voltron's shoulder, knocking him down.
That's the first time we've seen Voltron take that much damage like that, like been that down in a fight.
Right. So he's down on the ground. And he rolls while a Robeast tries to hit him with the sword several times.
Mm-hmm.
Voltron flies up to the top of one of the buildings and Keith says, "All right, team, let's go for it." Blazing Sword starts to get colors flowing all around it. Voltron jumps up and cuts both Robeasts in half all in one swoop.
It's a neat trick.
Yeah, it was something really strange that we hadn't seen before, where these colors were coming out of Blazing Sword before he jumped up and did it. We knew something was going to happen. All the former slaves come out and cheer for Voltron. And Keith says,
"People of Nemon are safe and free again. And whenever any world across the vastness of space is threatened with injustice or cruelty, good people everywhere can rest assured there is one who will always be ready to help. Voltron, defender of the universe."
So that was a good ending there. How did it end on Golion?
It was pretty similar to that, actually. It was just not as wordy. They defeat the Robeasts and then basically just take off again and say words to the effect of, "One day, we will beat the Drools."
Well, in a sense, it didn't seem as definitive in Golion that everybody here on, I guess it was Jara,
yeah,
were suddenly free, that they were still going to have to somehow face the wrath of Divazol. Did it seem like that to you? Well, yeah.
I mean, a lot of these defeats, you know, they win a battle, but Voltron comes in and kicks the Drools off Jara and then leaves, then what's to stop the Drools from coming back?
Exactly. That could still happen.
Yeah, and probably will.
Yeah.
Although in the Golion thing, the only thing that they seem to care about on that whole planet is making the monument, building the monument, which Dibazol is not shy about saying people are going to worship this. You know, people are going to worship my monuments. Maybe he even said that on the Voltron episode. I forget which, but he's very clear in his desire to be worshipped throughout the known galaxy.
Right, and Hagar had said that she wants nothing more than him to be the master of the universe.
Right.
So we still don't know what's in it for Hagar.
There was a really nice little moment there in the Golion episode where they're talking about the Viceroy. This guy, you know, he's built this huge monument to me, and cuts over to Hinerva, and she just says kind of under her breath, "Sycophant." That's suck up.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so it's always nice when you get the little bit of those interjections between the bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, they're just not nice to each other at all. So we've come to the end of the four episodes now. What did you think of that episode review?
I thought it was a lot of fun.
Okay.
Even though I've been a grumpy, picky old man.
Well, I got to tell you, there is a difference between watching these as a kid and watching them as an adult, obviously. You know, we wouldn't have picked it apart as much as this when we were kids.
Well, there's watching it as a kid, there's watching it as an adult, and then there's watching it as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's watching it as a writer who's actually worked within this universe.
Right.
You know, because I'm watching it, I'm analyzing it, I'm like studying it, you know? So yeah, it's a very different experience.
Which is why I thought it would be cool to have you on here to go over these reviews, because you've got a very unique perspective compared to me, that's for sure.
Well, you know, I'm looking at the combining sequence, and, you know, they jump on the cables and they travel down to the shuttles and they go out through all the tunnels with the different elemental components. And I'm thinking, wouldn't it be more efficient if you kept them all in the same place? couldn't you get the lions in the air faster if you, like, which is why in the Devil's Due comic, they're in a hangar under the castle.
But here's the thing, you know, you've heard that expression, don't keep all your eggs in one basket. You know, you don't want them all to be destroyed all at once, right?
Well, no, you don't, but they're also meant to be combined into one thing.
Right.
So if you lose one of the lions, you've lost Voltron.
Well, that would be a cool thing to see in an episode where you'd actually have them all go out to their lions. One's in the forest, one's in the sea, one's, you know, coming out of the ground, and one's coming out of the volcano. And, you know, Black Lion's coming from the statue. So at one point, if one of them couldn't make it to the rest of the group, what would happen?
Probably the rest of the group would go to wherever the lion was and got held up.
I would have liked to have seen something like that.
Plus, what if you lose your grip on those cables when you jump into the pod there, and, you know, it's like a really long way down.
Yeah.
To the shuttle. Butterfingers crunch.
Yeah, Mike had mentioned that in a previous episode about how they have to jump on those zip wire handles, and what if you missed? That would really be a painful.
It's not even a bat pole to slide down.
Right. Yeah.
And I know that the answer to a lot of the questions that I have is because it looks cool.
And because they're well-trained space explorers.
Well, yes. Yes. There was a whole week on grabbing zipline handles at the Academy.
At least they didn't have Sergeant Hulka from Stripes, right?
He was a great drill sergeant.
Oh, he was awesome. I love it when he got knocked down from that tower and mm-hmm. he's on his flat on his back and he's just like,
Yeah, great movie.
All right. So I want to thank you for joining me for this episode where we reviewed four episodes of the original series, Voltron, Defender of the Universe. We're up to episode 12 now. Next time we review episodes, we'll start with episode 13. going forward here, just so everybody's aware, I'm going to be going to San Diego Comic-Con, and like I said, we are going to hopefully get some surprise material from San Diego Comic-Con for the next podcast. And then after that, we are talking about doing a Vehicle Voltron podcast. So you're going to look forward to that one. And then maybe sometime in August, we might actually get to be able to get one of the original voice artists from that group of people that worked on the original Voltron. So look forward to those episodes. And Dan, is there anything you want to say before we go out here?
Just thanks for having me. Feel free to invite me back anytime. I will make myself available.
All right. Thank you very much, Dan. And we'll see you all next time on
Let's Voltron.